And I move that further proceedings on the roll call be dispensed with and the sergeant at arms be instructed to bring in the absent members.
Okay, on the motion, all in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Today's chaplain is intern Pastor Chris Johnson from Our Redeemer Lutheran Church in St. Paul, and then we'll say the Pledge of Allegiance after the prayer. How you doing there?
Good, thank you. To see you. Thanks for coming. You bet.
Good afternoon. Let us pray. God of all creation, of all peoples, we come together today as one group of people who come together to dialogue, to deliberate, and to discuss ways to make this city, this state, better for your people. Grant all people, all folks here gathered in this time that we share together, knowledge and wisdom, and also a love for people that you have created and continue to sustain. God, we thank you for the many ways you have blessed us, and we ask that you would work through these people gathered in this room, that they may be a blessing for many. Amen.
I pledge allegiance to the flag.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Good luck in your future.
Thank you, sir.
Secretary will take the roll.
Anderson, Bach, Berglund, Betzel, Bonoff, Carlson, Chaudhry, Clark, Cohen, Dahl, Dibble, Dill, Dahl, Erickson, Ropes, Fishbach, Phoebe, Foley, Fredrickson, Gerlach, Gimsey, Han, Higgins, Ingebrigtsen, Johnson, Jungbauer, Kielash, Koch, Coring, Kubli, Langseth, Latz, Limmer, Laurie, Lynch, Marty, Metzen, Michelle, Moi, Murphy, Olsen, Olson G, Olson M, Ortman, Pappas, Pariseau, Perry, Pogemiller, Pretner, Solon, Ress, Roebling, Rosen, Rummel, Saltzman, Saxog, Scheid, Senjum, Sharon, Sieben, Skoy, Skogan, Sparks, Stumpf, Tomasoni, Torres Ray, Vanderveer, Vickerman, Wieger.
Quorum is present. Pretty loud, but I guess it's introduction and first reading of Senate bills. There are three bills printed on today's Senate introductions without objection. First reading of Senate bills. Some authors' motions without objection will take those printed as one motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. There's one resolution on today's agenda. Without objection, the resolution will be sent to the Rules Committee. There are three motions to be read at the desk. Secretary will read the Senator Berglund. Uh, 3201 first, Senator Berglund.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. Pursuant to Joint Rule 203, I move that Senate File Number 3201 be withdrawn from the Committee on Finance and re-referred to the Committee on Rules and Administration.
Okay, this is your bill.
Yes.
On the motion, all in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Senator Berglund, do you have a second one?
I move that Senate File 1818, number 19, on general orders be stricken and returned to its author. This is a bill that did not make deadline in the House.
On the Berglund motion, all in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Senator Jungbauer, do you wish to make a motion?
Yes, Mr. President. I move that Senate File 2544, number 12, on general orders be stricken and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Now, this is your bill.
Yes, it is.
Okay, on the Jungbauer motion, all in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Senator Erickson Ropes, did you have a motion to make?
Yes, sir, I do. I move that Senate File 2429, number 36, on general orders be stricken and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
This is your bill. And
yes, it's my bill. Finance decided they needed to take a look at it.
Okay. On the Erickson Ropes motion, all in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Under motions, Senator Pogemiller, do you wish to take up the calendar?
Yes, Mr. President. I would move that we now take up the Senate calendar.
On the motion to take up the Senate calendar, all those in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Remind you that there will be four votes taken here. First bill on the calendar, House File 2668. The chief author is Senator Dibble. Third reading.
House File 2668, a bill for an act relating to landlord and tenant, modifying certain procedures relating to expungement.
Secretary will take the roll. All senators, having voted, desire to vote. Sharon. All senators, having voted, desire to vote. Secretary will close the roll. We had 55 ayes and 7 nays. The bill is passed. It's title agreed to. The second bill on the calendar. Number two on the calendar, House File 3164, the chief author is Senator Clark. Secretary will give the bill its third reading.
House File 3164, a bill for an act relating to higher education.
Secretary will take the roll. All senators having voted, Perry, desire to vote. Secretary will close the roll. There being 63 ayes, 0 nays, the bill is passed. It's title agreed to. Third bill on the calendar is House File 3393. This is a chief author, Senator Latz. Secretary will give the bill its third reading.
House File 3393, a bill for an act relating to real property, amending the Minnesota Common Interest Ownership Act.
Secretary will take the roll. All senators having voted, desire to vote. Secretary will close the roll.
62 ayes and 2 nays. The bill is passed. Its title agreed to. The last bill on the calendar, number 4 on the calendar, is House File 3286. The chief author is Senator Clark. Secretary will give the bill its third reading.
House File 3286, a bill for an act relating to metropolitan government limiting use of eminent domain.
Secretary, before the vote, Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. President. This is the best value procurement for transit vehicles for Met Council, and I have routinely risen against best value procurement practices because it only says that price must be one of the evaluation criteria. It doesn't say what level that must be for points. I wish and would feel much more comfortable if it were 50% of the evaluation criteria at least, but it could be as little as 10% under this proposal. I don't know if that is something that they would consider, is having it at least 50%, but I would like that assurance in the law, and this doesn't have it.
Third reading. Secretary will take the roll. All senators having voted, desire to vote, secretary will close the roll. There be at 46 ayes, 18 nays. The bill is passed. Its title agreed to. Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. President, remaining on motions and resolutions, I would move that we take up the general orders calendar.
I'll designate lists 1 and 2. On the motion, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion carries. Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. President, I move the Senate to now resolve itself into the Committee of the Whole for the purposes of taking up the general orders calendar.
Okay. On the motion, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, on your desk, members, there's a list 1. Is there also a list 2? I think there's a list 1 and a list 2 on your desks. Looks like about 15 or 16 bills. I would designate those, and I would yield to Senator Rest. Oh, and on list 2, number 36, Senate File 2429 has apparently been returned, sent back to the Finance Committee by motion this morning. So number 36, Erickson-Rope's bill, will not come up today. I'd yield to Senator Rest.
First bill under consideration, this afternoon will be Senate File 2511, Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when this committee do arise, that Senate File 2511 be recommended to pass.
Senator Rest, description of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 2511 establishes a collaborative governance council. There are a number of bills that have come before the Senate and the House this session looking for ways and different means, quite frankly, to streamline our government and our government resources, and this is one of them. The notion is not only to do more with less, but to do better with less resources where possible. And so this bill establishes this governance council and works with the state auditor's office that has agreed to assume any kind of fiscal impact, which is why the bill did not need to go to the Finance Committee, and involves the state auditor and representatives from the League of Minnesota Cities, townships, Minnesota counties, School Board Association, two councils of AFSCME, one in Greater Minnesota, one in the metropolitan area, Education Minnesota, and SEIU, and asked them to take on the task of developing recommendations to the governor and the legislature that are designed to increase collaboration in government, specifically asking them to review the statutes that now slow or prevent collaboration efforts, to look at the ways in which collaboration can improve the delivery of government services, to look at technology as a way of connecting entities that have not been able to do before, and including broadband access, and to modernize, look at the modernization of financial transactions and their oversight by facilitating credit and debit card transactions, et cetera. And then looking at and coming up with a creation of model forms, potential forms for joint powers agreements. And then by February 1st of each year to submit their recommendations, including draft legislation that would be necessary to implement its recommendations. The legislation is supported by all the groups that are mentioned. They are eager to begin, and I know of no opposition.
Further discussion on Senate File 2511. Seeing none, Senator Ress renews her motion that when this committee do arise, Senate File 2511 be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. The next bill on general orders, Senate File 2851, Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that when this committee do arise, that Senate File 2851 be recommended to pass.
Okay, Senator Lynch, a description of your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is an agency bill that was brought to me by the Minnesota Department of Health and has to do with health licensing, largely technical provisions and modifications. The proposed changes have been discussed with the licensing advisory councils, and there is no known opposition or controversy. There are five sections in the bill, and I'll go through them briefly. Section one, this changes, it deletes language to address an inconsistency in regulations for speech language pathologist and audiologist. The old language conflicts with a more recent change in regulations giving licensees 1 month following licensure renewal to submit their paperwork. Section two, this change eliminates a requirement that Minnesota Department of Health communications sent to speech-language pathologist and audiologist during an investigation be sent via certified mail. In fact, it's not necessary that all these written requests to MDH, to practitioners, be sent by certified mail. And in most instances, the department uses regular mail and can certainly opt to use the certified mail if they deem necessary. Section three adds language to correct a previous oversight by inserting a six-month time limit for completion at 480 hours of the supervised practice. Currently, there's no time limit in the regulation to obtain the 480 hours of supervised practice, whereas applicants who apply for licensure after a delay of 2 years must complete their supervised practice within 2 months. Sections four and five delete language to eliminate a requirement that occupational therapists and occupational therapy assistants who apply for a temporary licensure simultaneously submit an applicant for a permanent and full license. Temporary licenses vary in time from 90 days to 6 months in length. During this time, many applicants are transitioning from school to work or moving perhaps from another state. Requiring applicants to submit both temporary and permanent licenses at the same time often requires multiple follow-up communications to revise and update licensee information, and it's viewed that this change will promote some regulatory efficiency. And that concludes the summary of the technical modifications in the licensing bill.
Senator Lynch, do you have an amendment on this bill? Oh, okay. Any further discussion on the bill? Further discussion, seeing none, Senator Lynch renews her motion that when this committee do arise, Senate File 2851 be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. The next bill on that general orders, Senate File 2934. Senator Laurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that when this committee do arise, Senate File 2934 be recommended to pass.
Okay, Senator Laurie, on the bill.
Thank you. This bill makes revisions to the 2009 PCA legislation and to the certified assessor process under development. It assures the consumer-directed community supports option is offered to long-term care waiver recipients and provides flexibility in nursing facility business models. This bill was heard in Health, Housing, and Family Security, and there is no known opposition to any provision in the bill. Also, there are no fiscal implications to any provision. It is lengthy, but I will go through a quick summary of the bill. Sections 1 and 2 change provides nursing facilities with the ability to keep beds in layaway status for a longer period of time to allow their business models to be more flexible during the upcoming demographic changes. It also provides nursing facilities with instructions when converting layaway beds that were housing with services beds back to nursing facility beds. This was provisions brought forward by the long-term care industry. Section 3 states that a home health aide may assist a recipient to get two medical appointments if the care plan identifies this need. Sections 4, 5, 6, 7, and 9 clarify terms defined within the statute as well as activities a PCA may be paid to do and supervision of PCA activities and hours worked by a PCA. Sections 7, 8, 13, and 14 make modifications to the PCA training curriculums by assuring PCA training is made available in languages other than English and to those with disabilities that need accommodation, giving qualified professionals a longer period for training requirements in order to allow for DHS to develop an online curriculum, providing that Medicare certified agencies are exempt from certain training requirements, and assuring PCAs are properly trained for ventilator-dependent recipients. Sections 10, 11, and 12 make changes to the PCA choice option related to the recipient's responsibilities and clarify the parties that are part of the PCA choice agreement. Section 13 requires PCA provider agencies to document they do not limit recipient's choice of provider by limiting PCA staff to one agency or recipient. Section 15 expands the list of items DHS must provide to recipients in the PCA program. A requirement is also added to provide a service agreement authorizing PCA hours of service at the previous level when requested by a recipient while an appeal is pending. Section 17 allows lead agencies to choose to contract with a qualified certified assessor to conduct assessments and reassessments on behalf of the lead agency in accordance with DHS policies. Sections 16, 18, 19, and 20 assure that consumer-directed community supports information is provided to recipients of long-term care waivered services and instructs DHS to work with stakeholders during the comprehensive assessment development process to identify data that will modify the individual budgeting methodology. That is really a brief summary of what is in the bill. Again, it was heard in health policy with no known opposition, and I would appreciate member support. Thank you.
Further discussion on Senate File 2934. Seeing none, Senator Laurie renews his motion that when this committee do arise, Senate File 2934 be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Next bill on general orders, Senate File 3199, Senator Berglund.
I move that when this committee do arise, that Senate File 3199 be recommended to pass.
Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill deals with the state medical review team timelines. The state medical review team is the team that reviews applications for Social Security disability and helps to process those claims so that they can get on disability income through the federal government and Medicaid. The bill adds a new item to the list of information the department must provide to the legislature annually regarding the activities of the SMERT team. The report will include each appeal, the length of time from the date the person requests an appeal until a written decision is issued. The bill also will require that a written decision be issued within 90 days or 120 days when the commissioner refuses to accept the recommended decision. And if the decision is not issued within these timelines, the appeal must be immediately reviewed by the chief appeals referee. I would be ready for any questions.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Berglund renews her motion that when this committee do arise, Senate File 3199 be recommended to pass. All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Opposed, motion prevails. The next bill on general orders, House File 2639, Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that when this committee do arise, Senate File 2470 be recommended to pass.
That's the House file. Discussion on your bill. House file.
Okay.
It's a House file with the Senate language, so you're,
okay.
You're all right.
This is a bill that has come forward because of some tragic circumstances. Kelsey Smith was an 18-year-old from Kansas who was abducted and murdered in 2007. For 4 days, her parents, Greg and Missy Smith, along with police, begged their cell phone company to hand over the records that show the location for her cell phone. It took 4 days before law enforcement received these records from the company, but after receiving the information, authorities were able to locate her body within 45 minutes. Greg and Missy Smith came to Minnesota in February to tell Kelsey Smith's story. They have spearheaded an effort across the country to pass legislation that could potentially prevent this tragedy from happening elsewhere. I commend them on their work. This legislation would require cell phone providers to hand over cell phone records to law enforcement in the case of a missing person when there is a risk or threat of death or serious physical harm. This bill is pretty straightforward. It will give law enforcement another tool for protecting Minnesotans and hopefully prevent another scenario where law enforcement cannot get this necessary locational data from a cellular company to respond to emergencies of this nature. This bill has been passed in Kansas and is now being considered in Nebraska. The bill will strengthen the ability of Minnesota law enforcement to find a lost or missing person when death or threat of physical injury is possible. And that concludes my remarks on this bill, Mr. Chair. I would be happy to stand for any questions.
Further discussion on House File 2639, Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Prettner-Solon, would you answer a few questions for me? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Prettner-Solon, the bill that you have, I needed to ask a few questions. When law enforcement is asking for the phone companies to reveal location of where that phone might be, is there a request that the law enforcement, do they have to go to a court to get a court order or a subpoena in order to gain access to where this location of this telephone would be?
Senator Prettner-Solon.
No, they do not have to, Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer. But there are steps that and a protocol that they follow that must be followed before they can go forward to providing the locational data. And there is a form, there's a copy of it on your desk that they that has to be completed.
Thank you, Mr.
Limmer.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Prettner-Solon, the concern I have is that there's a lot of access now being demanded by government regarding the location of where cell phones might be. And we seem to be considering first the emergency nature of locating cell phones like your bill does. I'm very concerned that government will continue to demand location of where people are through the use of cell phones, and that basically this is a search. It's a government-sponsored search, and I'm concerned that government may begin to search for people without the types of issue background that your bill has. Could you explain what the protocol would be to me so that I might understand it better, why we are not seeking a court order in this particular case?
Senator Prettner-Solin.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, first of all, those other types of requests aren't included in this bill. And the companies already have the right, they may provide this information already, but it's at their discretion. And the companies wanted this language to protect them from liability. It certainly is wanted by the appropriate law enforcement, and it's wanted by the appropriate concerned parents and relatives who feel that their family member is in danger. But there has to be a serious belief that the person is in danger. I don't have the protocol, but each company has its own protocol that it follows. They actually get about 100 of these requests daily. Many of them are not of this nature, but they're requests where somebody is believed to have had a heart attack, and they've made a phone call, and then they've passed out, and they can't complete the call, or they lose contact with 911.
Senator, further discussion? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just make a comment with regards to Senator Limmer's concerns. Coming from the profession that I retired from, I certainly understand the need for this and understand the dire importance of getting this information, especially in a case like this. I really, really, truly understand that. But also, I think that it behooves this body to really monitor and watch this. And the reason I say that is, and I think I'm probably hitting on what Senator Limmer was talking about, is that the first time this is ever abused by government, or which would in general be law enforcement, is really going to set a precedent and really going to hurt, I think, the thing that we're after here, and that is to be able to assist the public in public safety issues. So I'm glad we're at least questioning that and staying on top of that. And I think the law enforcement community would want that, would want to make sure that it's clear and concise and it cannot be abused, because it's like anything else. Once it's ever abused, it's really tough to mend it up. So thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Prettner-Solin renews her motion that when this committee do arise, House Bill 2639 be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. The next bill on the general orders, House File 3174, Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when this committee do arise, House File 3174 be recommended to pass.
Senator Scheid, discussion on your bill.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, this bill prohibits the use of a homeless shelter as a primary address for predatory offenders registration purposes. Right now, people without a permanent address are required to do weekly check-ins with law enforcement if they are a person required to register and report. Right now, they're finding that some people are giving that homeless shelter as their address and then leaving, and when law enforcement tries to contact them, the mail never quite reaches them because they're gone. And this will ensure that they must abide by the requirement to check in person every week if they are a person without a permanent address. This also says that they have to give written notice when they move into the jurisdiction, and current law also refers to the fact that their status is terminated if they leave the state of Minnesota, but we know that sometimes they come back, so we're saying that that status is suspended, and then they have to register again when they come back. It's reactivated when they come back to the state. That's it, and I appreciate your support.
Further discussion on House File 3174. Further discussion, seeing none. Senator Scheid renews her motion. When this committee to arise, Senate House File 3174 be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. The next bill on the list, House File 3128, Senator Moi.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move that when this committee do arise, House File 3128 be recommended to pass.
Senator Moi.
Mr. President and members, House File 3128 was brought to me by a newly formed organization comprising of a number of organizations that work with work in the areas of guardians and conservators. This is called the Substitute Decision Making Network. The Substitute Decision Making Network arose out of the Guardianship Task Force, which was legislatively mandated to analyze laws governing wards, protected persons, guardians, and conservators. From the initial group, a subset proposed legislation last year, and the group now today has expanded to include several members in the discussions about various substitute decision-making tools in Minnesota. So these substitute decision-making tools include instruments like healthcare directives, powers of attorney, guardianships, and conservatorships. After we passed the package of bills last year in helping to clarify and establish new procedures for guardians and conservators, this language was brought back to help clean up that package of bills. So the overarching purpose of this bill is in Section 1 to clarify that only a court may declare a health care directive unenforceable due to current statutory restrictions. Section 2 of the bill establishes that a ward or a protected person may outline their health care wishes in a health care directive when a guardian does not have medical decision-making authority. Sections 3, 4, 8, 9, 10, and 11 of the bill streamlines the process by which guardians and conservators submit information to the court while assuring wards and interested persons still have access to the same information. Section 5 of the bill ensures that the ward or the protected person's nomination for a guardian or conservator is honored and respected when the time comes for a substitute decision maker to be appointed. Section 6 and 7 of the bill requires the court to make specific findings and delineate the ability for substitute decision makers to act, especially when a guardian and healthcare agent may coexist. Section 8 and 11 of the bill allows interested persons to opt out of receiving annual reports. And Section 12 of the bill corrects a technical citation error within the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act. Members, this is the bill, and I would stand for any questions.
Further discussion on House File 3128, Senator Glimmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Moi, I was hoping to get involved in a discussion with you today on this bill regarding an amendment I had. I just recently found out that this bill was coming up. The bill is being prepared for us now, but it is not complete. Would you progress your bill temporarily so that we could bring the amendment forward?
Senator Moi.
Mr. President, I'd be glad to progress the bill out of deference to Senator Moi.
Progress requested, progress granted.
Thank you.
The committee has before it now number 52 on the general orders calendar, House File 2851, Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that when this committee do arise, that House File 2851 be recommended to pass.
Senator Scogin has moved that when this committee do arise, House File 2851 be recommended to pass. Senator Scogin, on your motion.
Mr. Chairman, this bill will turn back two pieces of trunk highway, one in Coochiching County, the other in Ottertail County near the city of Fergus Falls, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Discussion on House File 2851. There being no discussion, Senator Scogin renews his motion that when this committee do arise, House File 2851 be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the motion prevails and the bill be recommended to pass. The committee has before it now number 58 on the general orders calendar, House File number 3143, Senator Mary Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move that when this committee do arise, House File number 3143 be recommended to pass.
Senator Olson has moved that when this committee do arise, House File 3143 be recommended to pass. Senator Olson, on your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, the Explore Minnesota Tourism Council was created in 2004 to provide advice and direction to Explore Minnesota Tourism. Which, as I'm sure the members are aware, is the organization in the state that promotes tourism, markets tourism, and does a number of functions related to tourism. The council is appointed by the governor and consists of 28 members representing various areas of the tourism industry. At the time the council was created, Minnesota had four tourism regions. Following a year-long review of the process with the tourism industry, Minnesota was reorganized into five tourism regions. The language in House File 3143 removes the reference to the number of tourism regions but leaves the category, thus eliminating any need to amend the language for this reason in the future, but allowing for a representative of each of these new five tourism regions. The bill maintains the reference to 28 voting members. Thank you.
Is there discussion on House File 3143? There being no discussion, Senator Olson renews her motion that when this committee do arise, House File 3143 be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the motion prevails and House File 3143 will be recommended to pass. The committee has before it now number 64 on the general orders calendar, House File number 1692, Senator Mary Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move that when this committee do arise, House File 1692 be recommended to pass.
Senator Olson has moved that when this committee do arise, House File 1692 be recommended to pass. Senator Olson, on your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File number 1692 is a bill that updates the Uniform Arbitration Act that Minnesota adopted in 1957. The 1957 law adopted the Uniform Arbitration Act as approved by the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws in 1955 and was ultimately adopted by 49 jurisdictions. This bill is the revised Uniform Arbitration Act approved by the NCC-USL in 2000 and already adopted by 13 other jurisdictions. This bill has been vetted and approved by the Minnesota State Bar Association as well as the American Bar Association. The bill does not change the substantive law of arbitration in Minnesota. It does add procedural safeguards that were lacking in the 1957 Act and is based upon the 40 years of legal development and experience since then. I'll briefly outline the major areas that are addressed in the bill. The RUAA provisions, which are not covered by the original Uniform Arbitration Act, determine arbitrability, so in other words, determining what is subject to arbitration. The revised act resolves the confusion over who decides what would be subject to arbitration, or what's called arbitrability, and by what criteria. The Act provides provisional remedies such as a restraining order, attachment, or other provisional remedy to maintain the status quo. It allows consolidation in situations where separate arbitrations involve the same transaction or parties. It strengthens the requirement that the arbitrator disclose conflicts of interest. It provides for arbitrator immunity, similar to the immunity currently available to judges. It gives authority to arbitrators to permit limited discovery when necessary. It provides for pre-hearing conferences that may be scheduled by the arbitrator.
It authorizes parties to an arbitration agreement to vary or waive some of the provisions of this act with limits to protect fairness. And it only applies where there is an agreement to arbitrate. In other words, it does not make an arbitration mandatory in any situations that are not mandatory at this under the existing law. And it finally, it was carefully drafted through the process of a lengthy and balanced deliberative process open to all interested parties. It has received the support and endorsement of many preeminent legal and arbitration organizers. Thank you, members. I'd stand for any questions.
Is there discussion on House File 1692? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Olson, you may know that I have a disagreement with the state getting involved in Uniform X. And Uniform X, I know there's a group of appointed individuals that are set to examine laws and write Uniform X that are in common parlance with other states so that the states would be the same on certain types of law. I kind of disagree with that. I think states should write their own laws and not necessarily follow right down to the dash and the dot and the cross T of everything that some governing board tells us. Now, under this Uniform Act, could you tell me how many other states have agreed to the uniformity of this language?
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Limmer, as you may recall, and actually I'm not sure that you were there. I think you might have been out to another committee meeting or briefly out of the room when we heard this bill in judiciary. But one of the things that was discussed at that time was that through the vetting process in the state of Minnesota, there were some minor changes before the bill was drafted, and so as it was presented, it did incorporate some technical minor changes that were thought to be by the attorneys and arbitrators in our state to be in the best interests of this law. And so we didn't exactly do the thing that you're saying you object to, which is taking it without any careful review and just taking someone else's word for it. But I think, as I said at the beginning of my remarks, so far there have been 13 other states that have adopted this Arbitration Act. Perhaps not the exact language being identical, but the substance of the language and the areas that it seeks to address as suggested by these changes being adopted by 13 other states so far. And I would also add, Senator Limmer, that as I said before, 49 states ultimately adopted the Uniform Arbitration Act. And you might ask me which was the one state that doesn't. I actually don't know what that is. But since over the last 50 years, since that original Uniform Act was adopted ultimately by other states, we have learned something about the process of arbitration, and it actually has become quite a bit more prevalent process. And so, as I said, there's nothing in these updates that really changes the substance of anything, but as arbitration has become more commonplace, there were a few areas that really didn't have as much guidance as it was thought it would be helpful to have. And so that's the reason for bringing this forward at this time.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Olson, on this board that writes these laws, we over the years have received uniform acts that we consider in the judiciary. I've asked the question, how uniform are the uniform bills? How many states have actually passed them? At one time, we only had four states that had passed it, and they were claiming it was uniform and that we couldn't change a single paragraph on the bill. And I know that there's this governing panel that's been selected to consider this. They're all attorneys, And what I find is only an attorney can figure out the confusion on these bills. Unless we can find an attorney to tell us what this bill is, I find it sometimes difficult to understand exactly what's on it.
Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, Senator Limber, as I was going to reference both you and Senator Higgins, so that's why I had her on my mind, as well as Senator Parisot, we have non-attorney members on our Judiciary Committee, as you know, and I've never seen you hesitate for a minute to wade into the discussion, regardless of whether a person has a legal credential or not. We know that Senator Higgins and any of the other non-attorney members who have been on that committee since I've been on it have been valuable members of the committee. And really, I think we have very good, thorough discussions. Obviously, we need to have some lawyers on the committee because it's a judiciary committee, and we're talking about things that we learn a lot about in law school and in our legal practice. But we also value the contributions from non-legal members, and I've never seen them to be any less valuable than the contributions we have from our non-attorney members.
Is there further discussion on House File 1692? There being no further discussion, Senator Olson renews her motion that when this committee do arise, House File 1692 be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion indicate by saying aye. Opposed, the motion prevails, and the bill is recommended to pass. The committee has before it now number 68 on general orders, Senate file number 2663, Senator Scheid.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill was brought to me by the Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association.
Senator Scheid.
It seeks to... Mr. Chairman. I move that when this committee do arise, Senate File 2663 be recommended to pass.
Senator Scheid has moved that when this committee do arise, Senate File 2663 be recommended to pass. Senator Scheid,
your
motion.
And again, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Members, this bill was brought to me by the Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association and hopes to create a lifeline for those auto dealers who were terminated due to General Motors and Chrysler bankruptcies. That is one of the missions of it. Well, that's the primary mission, but to give their a little better balance of power between the manufacturers and the dealers. And I am glad to tell you that the parties, the manufacturers and the dealers, have worked out language to which all agree. And so this bill comes to you, I believe, without opposition at this point, but I want to tell you what's in here. And instead of telling you just generally, I think I'll kind of do a section by section as we go. Section 1 adds a definition of area of sales effectiveness. That's kind of the geographic area where the auto manufacturer assesses the performance of a dealer. And it actually refers then to ties to Section 4. Section 2, I'll be offering an amendment to delete that, is absolutely totally technical. And was kept in there due to an engrossing error. Then Section 3 clarifies that although manufacturers can impose reasonable facilities requirements, doesn't mean that they can require a dealer to maintain exclusive facilities for that manufacturer's product or that car brand. If they have a separate voluntary agreement that gives exclusive use, then the manufacturer can insist on that exclusive use. But where they don't have that, then the dealer could offer another brand. Then there's a part of that section that says if the manufacturer is going to require a dealer to invest in substantial facility upgrades, that they give at least 6 months written notice for that. Section 4 has some cleanup language. We've deleted some language on page 6, line 21 through 28. That was only applicable to Saturn, and since Saturn is being eliminated, then that language is no longer necessary. That was current law. And then starting on page 8, This has to do with performance standards, saying that they must be fair and accurate. You know, for example, if a dealer is supposed to sell X number of light-duty trucks, but they haven't received an adequate supply, and they can't meet the objective, then this allows them to raise an objection that the performance criteria is not being fairly applied to them. Then, today, manufacturers currently have the right to just unilaterally change the geographic area within which a dealer's performance is assessed. Now, we're calling this the area of sales effectiveness for purposes of this bill, and this says that the dealer should at least have the ability to challenge the reasonableness of having that territory reduced if that's what's happening. That's if that's not being made with good cause. So that makes sense. Then there's Section 5 is a reorganization of kind of an existing concept in our current law. Currently, a manufacturer can't restrict a dealer from investing in or establishing any other manufacturer's line, and I think I referred to this before. So they have to have that separate and voluntary agreement. Then Section 6 is important. It requires the new General Motors and new Chrysler, which are the entities that came out of the 2009 bankruptcies of the old GM and old Chrysler, requires them to give priority to the dealers that were terminated if they decide to reopen dealerships in the market areas of the terminated dealers. It's offering a lifeline to those businesses that are fighting to stay open and providing protections to the manufacturers if they've had poor past performance, they don't have the financial ability, have character issues, unfit to own or manage it, then those are reasons why the manufacturer would not be required. If in the next 3 years they're going to go back into the areas they pulled out of in 2009, then these former dealers should get the first chance, and that's what that does. And then Section 7 helps dealers who are in the same factory family. For example, Buick and GMC truck, both owned by General Motors. If they want to consolidate their dealership facilities, then they would be allowed to do that. If a Buick dealer wants to move in with a GMC truck dealer, they're both willing to do it, turn two separate facilities into one. This prevents the manufacturer from unreasonably denying their request to do that. And members, I think this is an important bill for our auto dealers. I know we all have concerns about what's happened to them in this last year, and I will appreciate your support, and of course I would stand for questions.
Is there discussion on Senate File 2663?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Shine.
Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment to move. I'm so sorry. It was at Section 2. I alluded to it.
The Secretary will report the A3 amendment.
Senator Shine moves to amend Senate File 2663 as follows. Page 1, delete Section 2.
Senator Scheid, on your motion to amend.
Yes, and Mr. Chairman, this is entirely technical. It's removing a letter and an underscore.
Discussion on the A3 amendment. There being no further discussion on the amendment, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of adopting the amendment indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment's adopted. Further discussion on Senate File 2663. There being no further discussion, Senator Scheid renews the motion that what this committee do arise, Senate File 2663, as amended, be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill will be recommended to pass. The committee has before it now number 73 on the general orders calendar, Senate File number 525, Senator Pretner Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that when this committee do arise, Senate File 525 be recommended to pass.
Senator Pretner Solon has moved that when this committee do arise, Senate File 525 be recommended to pass. Senator Pretner Solon, on your motion.
Thank you. Senate File 525 establishes a regulatory system for technicians who perform body art procedures and for body art establishments. Under the bill, the Department of Health would be responsible for licensing body art establishments and technicians. This bill is a result of a three-year process which involved meetings with and input from the tattoo and body art practitioners, a review of the draft legislation by the Council of State Health Boards, a study which was commissioned by the legislature last year by the Department of Health, and consultation with the American Red Cross and the North Memorial Blood Banks. The bill was heard in the Senate Health and Family Services Committee, the Judiciary Committee, the Commerce Committee, the Health and Human Services Budget Division, and most recently, the Finance Committee. Blood banks, tattoo artists, body piercing technicians, and officials from the Department of Health all collaborated in bringing this bill to the floor of the Senate. The genesis of the bill came from a local tattoo artist in my district, but it soon became the number one priority legislation for the blood banks, who have taken an active lead in pursuing this legislation. Why is the bill so important to the blood banks? Without statewide regulation, people who receive tattoos or body piercing must wait 12 months before they are eligible to donate blood. Without a statewide law that requires single-use needles and ink and bloodborne pathogen training, potential donors are deferred from donating blood due to an increased risk of disease transmission. With statewide regulation, potential blood donors would be eligible to donate blood immediately. Donor referrals or deferrals have a rippling effect. In 2008 and 2009, nearly 3,000 people were deferred from donating blood in Minnesota, and this number only reflects the number who were deferred as a blood bank site. It does not include people who didn't even show up to donate because of tattoo or body piercing. Once a blood donor has been deferred, the donor is less likely to return to donate blood at a later date. Also, current blood donors tend to be older people. It is estimated that 40% of people under age 25 have received some sort of body art or piercing, which may explain the decline of younger donors. This legislation only applies to areas of the state that do not currently regulate body art establishments. Cities and counties that currently license body art establishments are exempt from this legislation as long as they meet the minimum requirements that are set forth by this bill. I ask for your support, and I will stand for any questions.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Pretner Solon, I'm reading through the bill. I've got a couple of questions. In Section 7, when it talks about professional standards, it mentions that technicians are going to require some kind of valid ID, picture ID to do these procedures. What is the reason to have IDs being recorded? I see later on in the bill that they have to be photocopied and kept on file. What is the purpose of doing that?
Senator Pretner Solon.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hamm, the purpose here is to identify the appropriate age, because anybody under the age of 18 is prohibited, in most instances, from having a tattoo.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So a person under 18 may not get a tattoo, but they could be permitted to get the other things. I was reading about some of the things that qualify as body piercing, branding, and scarification. Those things would be permitted under this bill?
Senator Pretner Solon.
There are certain... Mr. Chair, Senator Hamm, there are certain procedures that are permitted with the signature of a parent who is present at the time of the signing.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so, Senator Pretner-Solon, so the bill requires the parent to be present at the time that the body piercing is done, and they have to also provide a consent. Is there a form or something that they have to do?
Senator Pretner-Solon.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hamm, no, it doesn't require the parent to be present. They only have to be present with the technician at the time they sign permission for the procedure.
Senator Hamm.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Pertis, why is that practice need to be established? What is the purpose of doing that consent procedure in this bill?
Senator Pretner Solon.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, it basically was strongly urged by one of the body art technicians who felt very strongly that the individual, once they've reached the age of majority, may change their mind about this. And it was not something that people objected to vehemently. So in the past, they were allowed to have tattoos prior to the age of 18, but there were some technicians that did not perform them for people under the age of 18.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment I'd like to offer. It is the A50 amendment.
The Secretary will report the A50 amendment.
Senator Hahn moves to amend Senate File 525 as follows. Page 17, after line 30, insert Section 12. This is Amendment A50.
Senator Hahn, on your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. What I have here is a short amendment that repeals a section of current law. It is a section that deals with consent of minors for various health procedures. Right now we have a law that requires consent for any medical or other health service treatment to be administered, that a minor does not need to have consent of anyone, parent or otherwise, to do this. And so my amendment would simply repeal that provision and in effect require that parental consent be given for medical treatment to minors. And, Mr. Chairman, I'd like a roll call vote.
Senator Pretner Solon.
Mr. Chair, I'd like a ruling on germaneness, please.
There's been a request for a ruling on germaneness. The chair is looking for advice.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hamm.
Mr. Chairman, my advice would be to consider this amendment germane. This bill has to do with various procedures. There are provisions in the bill as it exists that permit licensed medical practitioners, doctors, nurse assistants, others that are licensed medical practitioners to perform things covered in this bill. So I think that the bill itself deals with general medical practices and also deals with consent. And I think that the section of law that I am repealing also deals with medical practices and consent, so I think it certainly is germane.
Senator Betzel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Of course, the test under germaneness in the Minnesota Senate is that if it fails either of two prongs, it's not germane. If it's a different, substantially different subject or a substantially different purpose, if either one of those is found, then it is not germane. And given the broadness of the repealer here, I think it could be not germane under either prong. It would be a substantially different subject and a substantially different purpose from the underlying bill. So, Mr. Chair, I would think that the amendment is not germane.
Senator Pretner Solon, did you want to be recognized?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say the same thing, that it relates to a different statute entirely, and that this is a licensing law that is related only to tattooists and body art technicians.
Mr. Chairman.
Members, I'm looking at the title of the bill that's before us, establishing a regulatory system for technicians performing body art procedures. And then I've looked at the section that would be repealed with the amendment 144343. That's in the Department of Health. And that deals with mental and health services. And I find that they're intended for substantially different purposes, so my ruling is that the amendment is not germane.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman, with all respect, I would like to appeal the ruling of the chair, and I would request a roll call vote on the repeal or on the appeal.
There's been a request for an appeal of the chair. Senator Pretner-Solon.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the ruling of the chair, and I would urge the members to support the chair.
A roll call has been requested. And the question before us is, shall the decision of the chair be the judgment of the Senate? So a green vote sustains the ruling of the chair. The secretary will take the roll. All senators voting who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. Senator Pappas, did you want? Senator Pappas votes yes. There being 45 ayes, 20 nays, the ruling of the chair is sustained. Further discussion on Senate File 525. There being no further discussion, Senator Pretner-Solon renews her motion that when this committee do arise, Senate File number 525 be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the bill will be recommended to pass. Committee has before it now number 34 on the general orders calendar, House File number 3460, Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, I move that when this committee do arise, that Senate File 3090 be recommended to pass, or House File 3460. Members, this is a bill that
Senator Olsen, hold just a second. Senator Olsen has moved that when this committee do arise, House File 3460 be recommended to pass. Senator Olsen, on your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a Department of Public Safety bill, and it simply redefines what a fleet is. Current law says that a fleet is three or more pro-ratable vehicles, and this simply changes it to one pro-ratable vehicle, and that brings it in compliance with the International Registration Plan. That's the bill.
Is there discussion on House File 3460? There being no discussion, Senator Olsen renews his motion that when this committee do arise, House File 3460 be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion indicate by saying aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the bill is recommended to pass. The committee has before it now number 53 on the general orders, House File Number 3263, Senator Gimsey.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when this committee do arise, that House File 3263 be recommended to pass.
Senator Gimsey has moved that when this committee do arise, House File 3263 be recommended to pass. Senator Gimsey, on to your motion.
Mr. Chairman and members, this is a bill that would allow the Department of Transportation to reduce speed limits down to 40 miles per hour in those cases where on two-lane roadways that the speed limit has been increased to 60 miles per hour, they would be able to establish the 40 mile per hour work zone speed limit in those work zones.
Is there discussion on House File 3263? Senator Youngbauer.
Mr. Chair, I have the A2 amendment.
Secretary will report the A2 amendment.
Senator Jungbauer moves to amend House File 3263 as amended pursuant to Rule 45 adopted by the Senate March 25th as follows. Page 2 after line 14, insert. This is amendment A-2.
Senator Jungbauer, on your A2 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, what the A2 amendment does, and members, it's a section that would be added about roundabout designs and speaks to the safety of roundabouts and a standardization of the design for roundabouts. The design and the manual that would be created out of this amendment would be in consultation with the Minnesota Truckers Association and representatives defined by the commissioner. So folks, that we would see what we've had with problems in roundabouts before. I don't know if members have heard of some of the trucks that have gone over the top of roundabouts, unable to make the radius of some of the short roundabouts. So it does create safety issues with some of the highways they're being used on today. And all this does is create a standard design for around the state that would be put out so that we know that these roundabouts are safe and that our trucking folks can get through them, and it doesn't create safety issues when these oversized vehicles or trucks using the highways that are already using them have problems with that radius within the roundabouts. I've already talked to Senator Gimsey, and I don't think this is a controversial amendment, members.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would Senator Youngbauer yield?
He will yield.
Senator Youngbauer, on the roundabouts, what would happen if you had a roundabout in a residential neighborhood where commercial vehicles weren't allowed? Would they have to comply to the same standards?
Senator Youngbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Skoy. No, I think that's the idea of creating a design standard for the specific roads that these roundabouts would be on. I know some of the roundabouts that have had issues with truck traffic were on Highway 12, where they do have a lot of truck traffic. And currently, members, there is no standard manual around the design criteria for roundabouts, and this would hopefully alleviate those problems and create some standardization in the design.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, and thank you, Senator Youngbauer. I just wanted to make clear that we could have different standards depending upon the usage of the road.
Further discussion on the A2 amendment? There being no further discussion, Senator Youngbauer has moved the adoption of the A2 amendment. All in favor of that motion indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Further discussion on House File 3263? There being no... Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair, I offer the A1 amendment.
The Secretary will report the A1 amendment.
Senator Carlson moves to amend House File 3263 as amended pursuant to Rule 45 adopted by the Senate March 25th as follows. Page 2 after line 14, insert. This is Amendment A-1.
Senator Carlson, on your amendment.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, this is somewhat of a safety amendment. It adds the language for the allowance of an A3 school bus to not have to have child safety restraints in it. The floor has already passed this language, but we wanted to put it into this bill to make sure that it does go through. And I'll stand for any questions.
Discussion on the A1 amendment. There being no discussion, we'll proceed to vote. Senator Carlson has moved the adoption of the A1 amendment. All in favor of that motion indicate by saying aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment's adopted. Further discussion on House File 3263. Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Chairman.
Chairman, I'm still waiting for an amendment. Would the author mind progressing the bill?
Excuse me. Senator Gimsey.
Mr. Chairman, we're more than willing to progress the bill and wait for Senator Vandeveer's amendment.
Progress requested, progress granted. The next item on the Senate calendar is number 30. The next item on the general orders calendar is number 39, Senate File 2790, Senator Moi.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. Mr. Chair, I move that when this committee do arise, Senate File 2790 be recommended to pass.
Senator Moi has moved that when this committee do arise, Senate File 2790 be recommended to pass. Senator Moi, on your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is the bill dealing, the omnibus bill dealing with it's a second chance bill dealing with juvenile records. The bill, I will just briefly summarize what's in the bill because I went through the bill pretty extensively last time the bill was before us. The bill modifies provisions governing public hearings and public access to juvenile records. It authorizes the expungement of certain juvenile records. It authorizes the Commissioner of Human Services grant set-asides or variances for certain individuals disqualified from licensure because of an offense committed as a juvenile. It requires chemical use screening of juvenile offenders. It requires the reviser to publish a table in Minnesota statutes cross-referencing collateral sanctions imposed on juveniles as a result of a delinquency adjudication. It clarifies detention placement options for extended jurisdiction juveniles pending revocation hearings. It modifies certain provisions regarding juvenile delinquency to include stays of delinquency adjudications, and it extends the duration of the continuance period allowed in a juvenile delinquency matter. And then the last time before we progressed the bill, Mr. Chair, members, I did an amendment to delete two sections from the bill dealing with 16 and 17-year-old hearings before the courts, as well as to put in the exception to military records so that juveniles can consent to the release of their military record, their private law enforcement records to the military. And I believe Senator Rest had an amendment to put her school safety bill onto the bill. Members, this is the bill. I'd be glad to take any questions.
Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, I have the A-10 amendment.
The Secretary will report the A-10 amendment.
Senator Dill moves to amend Senate File 2790, the second engrossment as follows. Page 1 after line 22, insert. This is Amendment A-10.
Senator Dill, on your amendment.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, this is a scaled-down version of a bill I had in front of Senator Moi's committee last year that tries to address the problems that young people may find themselves in if they wind up in a romantic relationship where there's more than 2 years difference in their age, or less than 2 years, more than 2 years of difference in their age. And I think most young people are not aware that if there is more than 2 years difference in their age, they can wind up with a felony conviction of statutory rape or third degree sexual criminal sexual conduct in a third degree. And this puts them into a situation they wind up being a registered sex offender for 10 years. And it's not a matter of one party saying yes or no. It could be a romantic relationship that develops through high school and And if one party turns 18 before the other one turns 16, so there's a 15-year-old with an 18-year-old, that can trigger this violation of this section of statute. So the amendment I have before you does two things. One is it requires that in the sex education classes that students be informed that what the law is so that they understand if they get mixed up with somebody that's quite a bit younger than they can have some serious consequences. And the second thing that it does is it changes the difference in age from 24 months to 36 months. And that's what the amendment does.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, members, I know that Senator Dill has been working really hard on this issue, and I've been working with him for the last several years to try to find a way to address this. I think that he is almost there, and he's trying really hard to put something on the books on this, so I support his amendment.
Sir, discussion on the A-10 amendment. There being no further discussion, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And would Senator Dill yield for a question?
He will yield.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator, when you talk about this romantic relationship where there ends up to be a conviction of criminal sexual conduct, which seems to be kind of, to be called that and then turn out to be that kind of a crime, the bottom line is, the question I'm asking, I guess, is do you expect those records that to be totally expunged at the age 18, or would you allow, maybe I don't understand your amendment, but would you allow an adult that committed that crime when he or she was a juvenile to allow a potential employer to look at that record?
Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, my amendment really doesn't deal with the expungement issue, but I don't really consider it a crime for two teenagers to fall in love and wind up in a sexual relationship. It's not I don't advise it. It'd be good if it didn't happen, but we all know that it does happen. And this last year, I was at a program that dealt with this very issue at the William Mitchell College of Law, and there were people that stood up and talked about situations that they had encountered. For example, the captain of the football team was dating a sophomore cheerleader, and there was no criminal activity between the two of them in their life. They had a clean record. But what happened was that they got into a sexual relationship. There was more than 2 years difference in their age, and this high school football captain wound up as a registered sex offender and convicted of a felony. And then somebody else stood up and talked about a valedictorian of a high school class who was a girl who wound up with a 15-year-old boyfriend, and she got into the same jam. So here you got two perfectly good kids that have got a felony conviction on their record and registered sex offenders, and it just isn't right. And I also, in my own Senate district, there's a nurse, and she's married to a house builder, a carpenter, and their son got into the same jam, and it was just like 2 years and 2 weeks difference in their age. And he's a registered sex offender in Glencoe right now for 10 years, and he made the mistake of moving from one house to the next in Glencoe without informing the probation officer. And he had the same telephone number, same town, same zip code, but a different street address. And he had to start his 10 years of registered sex offender all over again. So he's a registered sexual predator for another. It started over again, so I think it's been 14 or 15 years altogether. And then the editor of the Glencoe paper, his son got into the same kind of a jam, and so I'm trying to correct this problem and give a little more leeway, because these freshmen in high school to seniors in high school are 14 to 18 or 14 to 19 years of age, and they're mixing together in classes, and socially they're mixing together and so forth, and there's bound to be some situations where they wind up in a romantic relationship, and they don't even know they're breaking the law, because I've asked a lot of these teenagers about this, and they don't even know what the rules are. So the first part of my amendment requires that at least in the sex education classes we tell them what the rules are so they understand what they are, and so they can try to avoid some of these pitfalls that really damage their life for the rest of their lives. Makes it hard for them to get into college. at the William Mitchell College of Law, we heard from a young man who was the captain of the football team in Fergus Falls, who had been a registered sex offender since age 11. And in our state, we allow registration starting at age 10. But he was also the homecoming king at Fergus Falls. But when he got out of there, he was still a registered sex offender, and he had trouble getting into a college. And he was applied and goes denied and applied and was denied. And finally, a North Dakota college took a chance on him and took him in, and he turned out to be a star running back for their football team. So I'm trying to help these young people get out, you know, get past this time in their life and get on with their life and be successful. And if they make a mistake, let's not hang an albatross around their neck for the rest of their lives.
Is there further discussion on the A10 amendment? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would Senator Dill yield for a question?
He will yield.
Senator Dill, in looking over your amendment, I have to admit I like the first section, section one of your amendment, but section two changes a longstanding precedent in law regarding 24 months, the actor, the offender, is 24 months older than the complainant, or in this case, a victim. And now you're expanding that difference. You're relaxing the standard from 24 months to 36 months. Could you explain why? I know that you told about the football captain and the cheerleader, but outside of that couple, why would we want to change the law regarding this?
Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, if you look just above the, on page two of the amendment, if you look just above that, where they list all the things where you can be guilty of criminal sexual conduct in a third degree if any of the following circumstances exist. Item A, if you're under 13 years of age and the actor is no more than 36 months older than the complainant. In other words, we're using 36. If you're under 13, we're using an age difference of 36 months. Now, when we get over age 13, I just want to be consistent and go from the 24 to the 36. I don't know why we would we have a 36-month difference in age if you're under 13, and then over 13, you'd drop it down to 24. But the main reason for this is that there's all kinds of people that are socializing together and dating and so forth. They don't even know there's a possibility of a felony conviction if there's a more than a two-year difference in their age, and it's common for people to date people that are not their own age. It's very common. In my case, I married a woman who was 7 years younger than I, but I didn't start dating her until she was 21. So I guess I was okay. But there's plenty of examples where there's age differences that are significant, and 2 years is a very small difference. Boys mature more slowly than girls, and you've got some 19-year-old boys that are seniors in high school, and you've got some 15-year-old girls that may be even up, you know, moving ahead quite quickly and up in that junior-senior range already.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, I remember about a year and a half ago this same issue was discussed in the Judiciary Committee. It raised a lot of debate regarding changing this standard. And most recently, I was told that we had a discussion this March, or March 5th of 2009 also, in the Judiciary Committee. We never did come to arrive at a decision or arrive at a need to change the law, despite the fact that there was a lot of discussion in the committee. I think, although I respect the perspective that you have, that certain teenagers may either have limited opportunity to date people their own age, or perhaps they're dating people that lead to a more involved relationship between a wider age span. I am concerned because if I remember right, the reason we had these standards in law is to protect whatever innocence of a child might be left by the taking advantage of someone who might be more mature, and the only way we could define maturity is through age. And I'm concerned that this portion of the bill is going in this direction. Now, Mr. Chair, in light of this discussion, I would like to move to divide the amendment before us.
The amendment is divisible.
And it would simply be to divide it starting on lines page 2.1.
And Senator Dill, which part of the divided amendment would you like to take up first?
Mr. Chairman, the first part.
Okay, so the committee has before it now section 1 of the A-10 amendment, and section 1 is on page 1 of the amendment. Discussion on the first part of the amendment.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Coring.
Don't we have to vote on whether or not we're going to divide the amendment?
Senator,
we don't have to.
Senator Coring, no, that's at the any senator's request. Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, if anyone's listening, section 1 of the Dill amendment is one that I think most everyone would be accepting of, and I would speak in favor of that particular portion. Section 1 is found on page 1 of the amendment.
The committee has before it the section 1 of the A-10 amendment. Further discussion. There be no further discussion. We'll proceed to vote. All in favor of adopting section 1 of the A-10 amendment, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails, and the first part of the amendment is adopted. The committee has before it now section 2 of the amendment. Discussion on section 2. There being no further discussion.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I encourage you to support Section 2 of the amendment. This is a category. Senator Dill has explained the reasons why quite aptly. But I will note that for this age category, the provision in the statute that's being addressed provides that consent by the complainant is not a defense. So it's purely a statutory line drawing question. I think it's appropriate to adjust the lines in this particular case. I'll note that the proposal that was considered, I believe, by the Judiciary Committee had proposed to draw the lines at 48 months, and in fact the proposed amendment now by Senator Dill is at 36 months. So it's a more reasonable approach to this question. And it does not make any other changes to the other provisions in this section of law. So if someone is under 13 years old, there's still no excuse. Doesn't matter how much older you are under certain circumstances. It doesn't deal with force or coercion. It doesn't deal with whether or not you're in a position of authority or anything like that. It's purely the peer-on-peer relationships where essentially consent would become a defense if this provision is approved for that age group. There are no circumstances where a non-consensual relationship is allowed. That would still remain the law if this amendment is adopted. So I encourage you to support it.
Senator Hamm.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I am glad that the author has agreed to divide the amendment. I think that the first part of the amendment is the one that we've adopted is a good thing. I'm questioning the second provision, however. I understand that there are circumstances where teenagers get involved in things that maybe are beyond their capacity to use good judgment, but we do have pretty broad sex ed curriculums in schools. 3 years is a pretty significant period of difference when you're talking about somebody who's 14 or 15 or 16. And so I think that the change that Senator Dill is suggesting is a little more than I think we ought to be comfortable with, and I think we ought to vote no on the second half of the amendment. And I would ask for a roll call vote.
Are there three hands for a roll call vote? There's three hands. There will be a roll call. The committee has before it now the second half of the 18th amendment.
It's pages 2, 3, and 4 of the amendment. Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, I urge you to vote yes on this second part of the amendment. Let's not destroy the lives of some of our citizens by putting an albatross around their neck that's going to be with them for the rest of their lives. Is it really that big a sin to fall in love as a teenager with somebody that's less than 2 years or more than 2 years older than yourself or younger than yourself? Is that really a sin? Is that really a crime? Is that something we should hold up as being something so terrible that we're going to convict these people of being felons and make them register as a sex offender for 10 years? I don't think we want to do that. I know we don't. I know I don't want to do that. And if you look at the statistics of the percentage of students at different ages that have sex, we're talking about a lot of citizens out there that could be adversely affected by this. And I just want to expand the window a little bit. And as Senator Latz said, the proposal in committee that I had last year was 48 months. We've dropped that down to 36. All we're doing is we're raising the difference in age from 24 to 36 months. It's a reasonable thing to do. I urge you to please support this. Please vote yes.
Members, a roll call vote has been requested. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, like I mentioned before, I certainly can understand the relationship that you described between two people that were, in fact, somewhat romantically involved. But the purpose, I believe, that this original standard was put into effect was that not all relationships are so unanimous or consensual, and that some people with more maturity, little slickness in their heart, take advantage of young people, and they end up being more involved than, well, maybe I shouldn't say that. They're involved exactly at the degree of which at least the actor wanted to be involved, and that his or her sense of maturity and slickness is the thing that brought them to the act itself. That's what this bill, I believe, the original law was originally intended to protect. And that's why there's a concern about shifting this standard now that you're introducing on the floor. The Judiciary Committee didn't even want to come to a decision on it earlier in March of 2009, despite the fact that we had a discussion. So I'm not sure if this is an appropriate measure to bring onto the floor of the Senate at this moment because of the serious nature of this changing standard that you're proposing.
Members, we have before us now the second half of the A-10 amendment. It's pages 2, 3, and 4 of the amendment. Is there further discussion? There being no further discussion, a roll call vote has been requested. The Secretary will take the roll. All senators voting who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 43 ayes, 20 nays, the second half of the A-10 amendment is adopted. Further discussion on Senate File 2790. Senator Latz.
I have the A-53 amendment.
Secretary will report the A-53 amendment.
Senator Latz moves to amend Senate File 2790, the second engrossment, as follows. Page 15, after line 5, insert. This is Amendment A-53.
Senator Latz, on your A-53 amendment.
Mr. Chairman and members, the A-53 amendment is the expungement reform bill that is already currently in front of the full finance committee. This bill was a product of many years of work and compromise. Senator Ortman carried the bill for a number of years. And this year what we have before us is a pared-down version of the expungement reform, which is a compromise between the County Attorneys Association, the Council for Crime on Justice. So this is what everyone has agreed to as the consensus way to move forward on expungement reform. Two important points about it. What the bill does is currently under statutory expungement. If a case is resolved in favor of the defendant, then under the statute, if the expungement will extend to all records, including those maintained by the executive branch, the BCA, law enforcement agencies, as well as judicial records. Expungement in this case simply means a sealing of the records. The proposal in front of you then would extend the definition of resolved in favor of the defendant to include cases where there is a diversion program that is successfully completed, and that can only be done with the agreement of the prosecutor in the case, and also a stay of adjudication where there's a plea of guilty, but the judge agrees and the prosecutor agrees that the plea will be held by the judge rather than entered as a conviction. And then if that stay of adjudication is successfully completed, all the conditions are met, at the end of that period of time, the plea is vacated and the charges are dismissed. So in the end, their record ends up with no conviction by operation of either the diversion or the stay of adjudication. And then our expungement statute would reflect that positive outcome by not resulting in a permanent record open to the public. It does provide, at the request of the County Attorneys Association, a provision by which law enforcement, prosecution, and corrections authorities will be able to access the expunged records for purposes of investigative purposes without having to get an ex parte court order. Right now, frequently, you have these organizations or these individuals going into court to get a judge to say it's okay to look at these sealed records. This actually would save the judiciary time and effort, and it would save the county attorneys, law enforcement, and corrections authorities time and effort. I noted that it's in front of full finance right now. The Finance Division of Public Safety approved a provision with the concurrence of the Commissioner of Public Safety that the Department of Public Safety will absorb any costs associated with this act from within its existing budget. So let me repeat that. The Commissioner of Public Safety has concurred that they will absorb any costs within their budget. This has been through all the policy provisions committees as well, and I ask for your support for this amendment.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, members, Senator Latz has talked to me about this amendment. This bill was intended to be a part of this package, but it was sent to finance because of the cost implications. And now that the Finance Committee has had the okay from the department, we just want to add it back to the package as part of the Second Chance Coalition package. So I would ask for your support.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, would Senator Letts yield for a question?
He will yield.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Letts, in your proposal under expungement, you may be familiar with other sealing of records that the state of Minnesota has, namely the process of pardoning. Pardon extraordinaire is the legal term for it, and that's when a person who's led a life of no more crime after a period of time of the last sentence he was commuted can petition the state of Minnesota, namely the pardon board, which is made up of the governor, the attorney general, and the chief justice. And they can ask, due to their exemplary life since the time they were imprisoned or paroled, that they can seek a pardon officially from the state. Their records would be sealed, although the Department of Public Safety would keep their criminal records in file in the event that there was ever a return to crime. The question I had was, is how does your expungement language here relate to a pardon that I just mentioned in the area of sealing records? In this case, under your proposal, 1 year only needs to elapse from the final day of a sentence. And it has to be involving a diversion program or a stay of adjudication. So are we not giving the district court now the opportunity to essentially pardon? Isn't that a de facto pardon?
Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, the answer is no. The pardon board that grants pardons extraordinaire, first of all, it's rarely used in the scheme of all the convictions in Minnesota. Secondly, it applies mostly to convictions. The bill that, or the amendment that's before the body right now, does not apply to convictions at all. It only applies where up front, when the case is first in the district court, all of the parties, particularly the prosecutor and the defendant, agree that it will be handled in a way in which no conviction will result if certain conditions are met. In a diversion, the prosecution is suspended and the defendant is diverted into some other kind of justice-related program where they have to go through some classes or they have to take some specific affirmative steps to rehabilitate themselves. All the parties agree. If they successfully complete that, there is never, the charge doesn't even go forward. There's never any plea of guilty. Although some diversion programs even require a plea of guilty, and this would cover those as well. In a stay of adjudication, again, there may be a plea, but the judge has agreed, and the prosecutor has agreed. It cannot happen when it's over a prosecutor's objection. The prosecutor has agreed that if the defendant completes the conditions, there will never be a conviction in the first place. And the prosecution will not go forward from that point. But there is a plea of guilty in that case, so that if someone does not comply with the conditions, for example, does not attend chemical use programming or treatment, or does not take certain other steps, does not complete some work crew service, does not pay the prosecution costs, or does not pay whatever the money that's involved is, then a conviction would be entered and this expungement would not apply. But if they do complete everything they're supposed to, no conviction is entered because of the agreement between the judge and the prosecutor and the defendant, then this remedy of expungement or sealing of the records would apply as well. Essentially, what happens then is it does not hang a non-convicted criminal charge over a person's life as they're applying for housing and as they're applying for jobs. If they get convicted, it's a different story, and this amendment does not address that situation.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Letts, the diversion programs that you talk about, I don't see a definition of a diversion program. Are we leaving that up to the district court system to provide or recognize a diversion program that works in their respective district?
Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, yes.
And Mr. Senator Chairman, Limmer. Senator Letts, one other question. Is this only in regard to adult cases, or does this involve juvenile as well?
Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, it does not specifically apply to juvenile cases. It applies, I think, to anyone who is prosecuted as an adult for the offense. Now, there are some offenses which are some certain kinds of traffic offenses, for example, that depending on your age, it may be handled in the juvenile court system or it may be handled in the adult court system. There is not a distinction made within this particular amendment, so I can't be certain as I'm answering your question, that's the best I can do right now without doing a little research for you. And I'm happy to get the information to you.
Further discussion on the A53 amendment? There be no further discussion. Senator Latz has moved adoption of the A53 amendment. We'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of adopting the amendment indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Further discussion on Senate File 2790. Senator Perry.
Mr. Chairman, would Senator Moi yield for question?
She will yield.
Senator Moi, I'm just trying to get a handle on this. You want to seal and expunge these records. Can you just explain that a little bit and why for me?
Senator Moi.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perry, the Minnesota criminal expungement statutes doesn't have specific provisions dealing with the sealing of juvenile records other than when the juvenile was certified to adult court. There is a juvenile records expungement statute that merely states that the court may expunge the adjudication of delinquency at any time that it deems advisable, but it offers an inadequate remedy for sealing juvenile records because it provides no guidance to petitioners, judges, and attorneys regarding guidelines and procedures. So there has been confusion and ambiguity in the law about whether judges have the authority to seal executive branch records when sealing a juvenile record, and especially when so many judges rely on their interpretation of limited inherent authority of the court and will only seal court records. So what we're doing here is simply to provide that juvenile records should have the opportunity to overcome barriers created by the record and give them an adequate access to opportunity for personal and social growth by putting into statutes more clarity and more process for juveniles to have the opportunity to seal their records. It's not automatic. They still have to go to the judicial process the same way that grown-ups have to go through the judicial process.
Senator Perry.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Moi, I have another question here. How would this affect police and fire? For an example, in the employment category, somebody comes and wants to become a policeman or a fireman, and they've been convicted of some form of property crime, burglary or arson or that. Would the police and fire then have the opportunity to go in and find this out as they're researching for employment?
Senator Moss.
Mr. Chair, members, the juvenile records would not be treated any differently from how we currently treat adult records that get expunged or sealed through a court petition.
Further discussion on Senate File 2790. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator Moi, I too am concerned about some of the aspects of this particular bill. And as you may remember, we had this bill before it was laid on the table. And I'd like to bring us back to that by introducing the A54 amendment.
The Secretary will report the A54 amendment.
Senator Limmer moves to amend Senate File 2790 as follows. Delete everything after the enacting clause and insert Section 1. This is Amendment A54.
Senator Limmer, on your A54 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Moi, the amendment before you is essentially your bill, minus the provisions that seal and expunge juvenile criminal records. There are a number of people that believe that the existing standard for keeping those records open, available for police to look back, for certain employers in key employment areas to look back, that should not be changed. And so the A54 amendment is essentially your bill, but without the elements of sealing of juvenile records and expunging them from the public record. Senator Perry raised a question, and we also had a person testifying, not to this bill, but to another bill in judiciary, a fire chief, who claims that in his rural area, to get volunteer firemen and firewomen, he needs to hire young people that might be 18 or 19 years old. But with your provision of law, if it became law, he would be restricted from looking back, a 19-year-old looking back even 1 year for a potential criminal record that may be there or other information that the police would may have. He would be hiring volunteer fire department that would be entering homes and going through them. So I think Senator Perry, his concern over the employment in certain areas certainly raises questions that should be discussed. I've done nothing in this amendment to change anything else. We had a few amendments the other day when the bill was originally introduced. Senator Moy, you introduced an amendment that was passed allowing military look back for recruiting purposes, and Senator Rest also had one on BB guns on school grounds. That still remains in this proposal. It's only the existing areas of sealing juvenile records.
Senator Moy.
Mr. Chair and members, I think that Senator Limmer, even though Senator Limmer was chairing the committee when I presented this bill before the committee, and Senator Limmer has had an opportunity to look at the bill, I think Senator Limmer misunderstands the intent of the two sections of the bill that Senator Limmer is attempting to remove, which in essence guts the substance of the bill. The release of juvenile records law does not change the release of juvenile records for background checks required by statute or interagency governmental access to juvenile records for those who need to know. It would simply make private juvenile peace officer records comport with BCA records law, which currently prohibits the release with informed consent. And parents and subject of the record could still get a copy of the record directly. And then we amended it to allow for consent to be released to a third party if it involves the military. So people who need to know the information, as it currently is at the BCA, can still have access to this information, specifically law enforcement. Again, I just want to repeat that the section with respect to the expungement is not an automatic expungement. The petitioners still have to go through a process. And even though there's very little language in the law about that, or because there's very little language in the law, it creates ambiguity and doesn't offer people the kind of process opportunity that we need to give them. So, members, I hope you will vote against the Limmer's amendment and give support to my bill.
Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm not an expert on all this. I'm not an attorney, but I can read the list of organizations here that support this bill. And I would think that most of us would probably think the Minnesota County Attorneys Association would know a lot about this subject. And they are supporting Senator Moy's bill. And then there's the Association, the Council on Crime and Justice. And there's the Minnesota Corrections Association that support this bill. The Minnesota Second Chance Coalition, which is made up of perhaps 40 organizations listed here, all support this bill. So I would urge you to support the bill and oppose the Limmer Amendment. But in addition to that, I would like to remind people of what we talked about a few days ago. And that is the idea of giving people a second chance, giving them an opportunity to get a job, to find housing, to get into college. And a lot of people make mistakes before their brain is mature. Our brains mature usually around age 25. There's a lot of juveniles out there that are dumb enough to throw rocks through windows and burglarize and vandalize and steal and beat up people and so forth. But when they mature, we need to give them a second chance. And I would hope the employers of this state would have enough guts to hire an ex-crook. Because if they don't, what are these people supposed to do? They get out of prison, they're on probation, They're out in society again. And if they can't find a job and they can't find a place to live, how are they going to eat? We're really forcing these people back into a life of crime, and we kind of wonder why the recidivism rate is so high. It's high partly because we have it's partly because of this document right here. It's 5 pages of occupations you can have if you've been convicted of a felony. And we keep doing it over and over and over again. Even Senator Betzel's dog and cat regulatory bill had a provision in there that said that if you've been convicted of cruelty to animals, you can never, ever again work on your dad's dog farm. And I think that's outrageous. Now, he took that part out during the last version that he offered in the Ag Committee, but we have to create an environment here where we've got enough guts to let people have a second chance, even if there's some risk involved. And actually, I think we're increasing risk. We turn these people loose. They can't find a place to live. They can't find a place to work. They can't get a salary someplace. What else can they do but return to a life of crime? And so we're actually increasing the risk of crime. We think we're protecting the public by saying you can't have this job, you can't have that job, you can't do this and that and so forth, and you can never be a chiropractor and so on. We think we're protecting the public, but we're really making it more dangerous for them, because these people do eventually get out of prison, and what can they do? I could read this long list of bills and occupations you can't have. You can't even curry a horse at Canterbury Downs if you've been convicted of a felony. You can't even be a private detective. I would think that if you're an ex-crook, you'd be a darn good detective. There's all kinds of occupations here. You can't sell gambling equipment. You can't be a horse jockey. You can't sell gambling equipment. I mean, it's pretty comprehensive on all the things you can't do. So we're penalizing people for the rest of their lives, and it's not right. We got to give people a second chance. So let's have enough guts to vote the Limmer Amendment down. Vote for the Moi bill. And let's do a little something to change the environment in this state so that ex-crooks have a second chance.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, members, I just want to encourage the members to vote down the Limmer Amendment and then support the Moi bill. In addition to some of the organizations Senator Jill just listed, I'll note the Goodwill Easter Seals of Minnesota, the Greater Minneapolis Council of Churches, the Minnesota Catholic Conference, and the Nonpartisan League of Women Voters of Minnesota all support the underlying bill, an important part of which, the core of it, of which is the juvenile justice expungement provisions. It's been stated quite eloquently already that sometimes this is the key to someone being able to get a job, someone being able to find housing, to be able to put food on the table, to support their family, and to give them a chance to be productive, effective citizens, rather than forcing them or making it so hard for them that they turn to a life of crime or they turn to alcohol or drugs as an escape. This is indeed an important provision that we have before us today, and particularly when you're dealing with juvenile records, because juveniles, the whole purpose of the juvenile justice system is to give people a chance because they're younger and perhaps have less judgment when they commit the offenses as juveniles to return to society with a cleaner slate and have a chance to be a productive citizen. The Limmer Amendment would remove an important provision that would move in that direction. So I encourage you to vote against the Limmer Amendment and to support the bill itself.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just some comments with regards to Senator Dill's comments. And I understand a certain amount where he's coming from. I've worked with criminals over the years that have been put in prison and have come out and have got gainful employment. Is it tough for them? Yes, it is. But if they want gainful employment and they're able to get out there and do it, they can. And I've been part of that process where there is actually some of them working. The State Sentence to Serve program, ICWC program. But where we're going here, and I should caution folks, is that when we talk about juveniles, it seems like we're talking about, at least in this body here, about kids are going to be kids. And all of a sudden they turn 18 or 19 years old, and now they're big boys and girls, and now they're all of a sudden really smart. I'm here to tell you that there's an awful lot of young kids that are underage, that are juveniles we're talking about here, that are watching what's going on and knowing that if they get convicted of something, oh, well, that's not a big deal. I'm still not an adult. I can just go ahead and do what I want. There's a lot of gangbangers. There's a lot of gang folks in the state of Minnesota that are underage, that are juveniles, that are going to be committing some crimes, that are very serious players. They're very serious offenders. And to walk away from those folks that commit those crimes and not allow the general public to have access to those records could be very detrimental. But yes, I do understand that there are some out there that actually do change their ways, and it is somewhat troublesome. So I'd ask for a roll call on this.
A roll call has been requested. Are there three hands? Three hands, there will be a roll call. Further discussion on the A54 amendment. Senator Latz.
Just one other comment, Mr. Chair and members. The provisions in the bill are not an automatic expungement. They are review by a judge. And where a judge concludes by clear and convincing evidence that the interests of the public and public safety outweigh the disadvantages to the petitioner not sealing the record, then the expungement does not happen. So it does leave a lot of authority in the judge's hand to review the situation for those really bad apples that Senator Ingebrigtsen was talking about. But in many cases, they aren't quite so bad, and they are prepared to take a new step in life. And they've demonstrated a history of rehabilitation and of walking the line appropriately. And in those cases, this will give the judge the opportunity to seal their records so they have a better chance to stay on that positive path.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad we're having this discussion today. It wasn't too long ago in the Minnesota legislature where we debated this and opened up many of these juvenile crime records. It was a result of some rather rampant behavior on the streets in our urban areas regarding crime caused by juveniles. Street gangs were rampant in the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Minneapolis was termed Murderapolis by these thugs that were on the street, many of them juvenile, and many of them involved in the funding of the street gangs through theft and property crimes. This legislature wisely decided to open those records for these criminals and keep them open so that when they moved out of the juvenile record or the juvenile age to adult, that we knew who they were. Now we have a proposal before us to shut the door on it and seal it up. I think that's wrong. I think that's unsafe. And for those who propose this type of an idea, I think it's dangerously naive. All this amendment is doing is recognizing existing law that's already on the books in the state of Minnesota. And instead of taking that giant step to seal up juvenile records, we're simply saying that goes a little too far, a little too fast. Maybe a little more thought should be employed on this area of law. We have a long list of people who say they love the idea of sealing up records on criminals. You know, regardless of age, criminals. And although I do recognize the need for a second chance for young people, there has to be more proof that they're changing their ways than simply becoming the age of 18. I think this is important. And I hope you join with me in this.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm all tangled up here. Sorry about that. Mr. Chair and members, I have been a strong advocate in favor of expungement, and I've learned so much about the process and about the different interests of law enforcement and public safety, the criminal justice community, the interests of the folks involved. I'm a very big supporter of a second chance for folks that have earned it. But I have concerns about this bill, the way it's currently drafted, And in particular, one of the interest groups that came to the Judiciary Committee was the Newspaper Association. And they said that they had an interest in monitoring the proceedings in our courts when very significant crimes were involved, including those perpetrated or allegedly perpetrated by juveniles. The concerns that they brought to the committee have not been resolved. In fact, the language in Section 18 of the bill, I think it is, goes quite far to say that the judge shall close the proceedings to the public. We should all be concerned when a bill authorizes that all proceedings in court be closed to the public. There's also one other provision in here that is very disconcerting. In Subdivision 18, the balancing test. We want to be able to close the records if there's no concern about the public safety involved, but that's not what this bill does. This bill goes way beyond that. This bill imposes on law enforcement or the prosecutors the burden of establishing by clear and convincing evidence that the interests of the public and public safety outweigh the disadvantages to the petitioner of not sealing the record. Ladies and gentlemen, what we're saying here is that a person is entitled to an expunged or a sealing of a record unless the prosecutor can prove by clear and convincing evidence that there's a public safety interest. Well, why should we hold these prosecutors to such a high standard? It was proof beyond a reasonable doubt to get the conviction, and now we're going to say you have to meet an even higher test to seal the record. Clear and convincing evidence is even beyond what we require in our criminal courts of law. It is the highest legal standard in the law. This bill just goes too far. The Balancing Act, which must be so carefully balanced in order to get this right, is out of balance. And so I support what Senator Limmer is doing to try and restore the balance and put back into place or maintain current law until we get the balance properly divided here.
Is there further discussion on the A54 amendment? Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, I just need to correct something for the record. I think Senator Ortman misspoke. Clear and convincing evidence standard is the middle ground standard. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt is the highest standard in the law required for conviction of a crime. Preponderance of evidence is more likely than not. It's a standard civil standard that's used. Clear and convincing evidence is in between those two. It's the typical standard used for probation violations and for certain other proceedings, including what's proposed here.
Senator Ortman, did you want to respond? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more comment. You know, we've been talking about the folks that are doing things wrong here, the juveniles that are offended, that are offending, as Senator Dill so eloquently talked about, the affair that was in the back seat, and so we go on and on and on, and we talk, and I brought up the talk about the gangbangers and what an influence they are in our communities. But not too often do I hear anybody talking about the ones that are actually watching what's going on today, that are actually doing it right, that aren't going out to the beer parties, that aren't going into the back seat for that first time, that aren't going to join the gang. Those people are watching as well. Those are the ones that are doing it right. I've never heard anybody talking about the ones that are doing it right, the kids that are probably getting some help from home, that are saying no to some of these things. Be careful when you send this kind of a message to those kids that are doing it right, that, you know what, I guess maybe I can go because, gee whiz, later on when I hit that golden age, it's going to be sealed up and nothing's going to happen. Let's start thinking about the ones that are doing it right as well.
The committee has before it Senators Limmer's motion to amend with the A54 amendment. There's been a request for a roll call vote. There being no further discussion, the secretary will take the roll. All senators voting who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 22 ayes, 42 nays, the motion to amend does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. Further discussion on Senate File 2790. There being no further discussion, Senator Ma renews her motion that when this committee do arise, Senate File 2790 as amended be recommended to pass. There being no further discussion, proceed to vote. All those in favor of that motion indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the bill will be recommended to pass. The committee has before it now number 75 on the general orders calendar, Senate File number 2386, Senator Metzen.
Now, Mr. Chairman, I move that when this committee do arise, that Senate File 2386 be recommended to pass.
Senator Metzen has moved that when this committee do arise, Senate File number 2386 be recommended to pass. Senator Metzen, on your motion.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill ratifies the state labor contracts for the biennium. These contracts and compensations plans have been reviewed and given interim approval by the LCC Subcommittee on Employee Relations. The contracts do not provide any across-the-board increases in salaries. Except in the second year, there could be part of these bargaining agents could go in for what they call a step performance step-base increase the second year. But, of course, the first year, there's 0% increase. Also, there's no substantive change in the employment insurance program. The Department of Minnesota Management and Budget estimates that this collective bargaining agreement will cost the state .057 in this biennium, and most of that is due to the employment match and state employee retirement benefits. I could go through, I think I will. This bill ratifies 11 elective or collective bargaining agreements, all the way from AFSCME, MAPE, the Minnesota College faculty, Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, I guess I mentioned that, Minnesota Middle Management, MINSCU, and the Managerial Plan, Minnesota Law Enforcement Association, Minnesota Nurses Association, and I think I probably have all of them. And they collectively represent about 42,000 state employees. So I ask for support from the committee.
Is there discussion on Senate File 2386? Senator Perry.
Mr. Chairman, will Senator Metzen yield?
He will yield.
Senator Metzen, just a question. As I read this, are we saying that we as a body here will vote to ratify this, and it shows a $39,545,161 increase?
That is correct. That's a two-year number.
Would you explain?
Senator Perry.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Senator Metzen, could you just briefly explain exactly where that $39 million is going to? Because I, this weekend when I was back, still have people in my district that are becoming unemployed, that have not had any raises, no cost of living raises, have had to spend more money on their insurance to keep their insurance because the employers have a problem with the economy, as many of us do, and I really have a hard time voting on something that shows a $39 million increase.
Senator Metzen.
Yeah, this is mostly to do with the contribution from the state for the retirement plans. So and it's more than matched by the employees. So, again, let me say, Senator Perry, I did not negotiate these contracts. The current administration did, so I'm just the guy kind of carrying the bill along the way here, Senator Perry. So
maybe you're going to have to go down a floor or two and talk to the real people that put this together. But they, seriously, they acted in good faith. It's collectively bargained for, and that's the way the system works. And you might not like the numbers, but this was the way bargaining takes place.
Senator Perry.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metz, and I don't want to kill the messenger here. I know we've talked about this before, but it's amazing that we're giving increases even to the retirement funds or pension funds. What would happen if we didn't? Like the private sector, who can't? But yet we're asking our citizens to invest into the pension funds of our public employees during this economic time when their own employers can't do this. And I just think this is sending a wrong message and the wrong thing to do at this time. I really believe we should vote no on this.
Further discussion, Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. President, or Mr. Chair. This is really a catch-22 for us. I really feel strongly that we shouldn't be seeing any increases in wages and benefits right now when we have the large deficit that we have, and the people in the private sector, many of them are taking pay cuts to keep their jobs, real pay cuts, 5-10% income cuts, sometimes even more, 20% I've heard. And I mean, that is not unusual. And so to see contracts come in, and it isn't all of them. There's a couple of them in here that really are solid freezes that aren't going to cost anything more, but the majority are going to cost the state taxpayers more money. And it's difficult, but I know the problem that we have that we're caught in the catch-22 here is if we don't agree to this group of contracts, it reverts back to the old contracts, which would cost us even more money. And so I feel it's really unfortunate what has happened here, because either way, we're going to be paying more. And the only way would be to go back and renegotiate these contracts. And I don't know, Senator Metzen, if you would yield to tell us what would happen if we rejected the contracts, we asked for renegotiation, short of going back to the original contracts with the steps and lanes increases in them, would we actually be able to bring the unions to the tables to renegotiate? Do you know that?
Senator Metzen.
Well, I just want to, if we don't do this, we revert to the prior contracts, my friends, and it will cost the state more.
Further discussion on Senate File 2386. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Metzen, how would that work if we go back? I thought the fiscal note showed that it had a $40 million increase in this budget. How would we be spending more money in the event that this is not ratified?
Senator Metzen.
The prior contract had steps in both years. This one does not have the step in the first year. That's why it's going to... would cost more to go back to the prior contract.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, I know that labor negotiations are sometimes difficult from our perspective to try to alter in any way. Currently, Senator Metzen is bringing this bill before us, representing the interests of both labor and the administration. And a year ago, during the unallotment discussion that the governor was involved with last year, there was a request from the governor's office if there was any ideas that anyone could bring forward to save $1 billion of costs. There was $1 billion in the budget that he was trying to adjust. And we all were asked, I made a suggestion that, well, why don't, instead of maintaining salaries of employees, why don't we suggest for union leaders to negotiate, instead of firing or laying off people, maybe they could negotiate an across-the-board reduction in salary. Matter of fact, a 10% reduction in every salary in the state equals about $930 million, just a 10%. The benefit of that is that everyone keeps their job, everyone keeps their health insurance, and nobody gets fired. In light of a bad economic condition, that might be a good thing to maintain that stability in everyone's homes that are involved, rather than laying off 10 or 15 or maybe 20% of all of our state employees and having 15, 20% victims due to the economy. I have an amendment, Mr. Chair, that I'd like to introduce with this little bit of a buildup, the A2 amendment.
The Secretary will report the A2 amendment.
Senator Limmer moves to amend Senate File 2386 as follows. Page 3 after line 16, insert. This is Amendment A-2.
Senator Limmer, on your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Metz and I passed this on to you earlier, and you weren't too hopeful with my amendment. But nevertheless, it's something that we need to have a discussion on in the public, and that is, once a union and an administration ratify an agreement, what happens is there's basically no other alternative except to lay people off if there's a deficit in a year of budget revenue building. This amendment would allow the unions as well as the commissioner to simply consider, instead of layoffs, to reduce the compensation if that occurred. That way it would bring a little stability to the people that are the families that may fall victim to a bad economy and hence a bad revenue stream in the state of Minnesota. We wouldn't have to lay off anybody, and the only pain involved in it is they may have to absorb a pay decrease. We keep the stability, nobody loses their health insurance, and the stability of the home is maintained as best as possible in bad economic times. It doesn't mandate, it simply says, please consider. And I'd be open for discussion, Mr. Chair.
Senator Metzen.
This amendment is not needed at all. This could be negotiated now. And they've talked about it, and it's not part of the collective bargaining agreement. So it's not a foreign subject you're talking about here, Senator Limmer. It's been talked about, and it's not part of the negotiations at this time.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metz, and I brought this issue up before the administration last year of whether or not that could happen in light of layoffs. And they basically said, we can't go there. It won't work. We're not allowed to do this in this direction. We can only lay off. And we don't have that opportunity to impose any type of lessening of compensation at all. So in light of that, here we have a moment to change. Here we have a moment to consider putting this type of thing into an agreement to ratify. And I ask for a roll call vote, Mr. Chair.
Then roll call has been asked for. Are there three hands? There will be a roll call.
Just one
Senator Metzen.
I did not negotiate these contracts. The administration did. The Republican administration.
Senator Sanjum.
Mr. Chairman, I've been listening along the way here, and I think what Senator Limmer has brought to us is an opportunity that we ought to really think a lot about as we go into, certainly, or as those who grace this chamber next year go into the legislative session. We're going to be looking at a massive, massive budget deficit, $5.8 billion. And there will be definitely cuts. There's no question about it, massive cuts. To the extent that an amendment like this might be put into law and be there to work with respect to rather save an employee than lay them off, I think the state is better off for it. If we can work something out vis-a-vis the amendment that Senator Limmers offered. I think that's to our strong advantage, and we ought to really strongly consider it, and I would urge a positive vote.
Senator Dibble, did you want to be recognized? Senator Mary Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just quickly remind members that, and what I thought I heard Senator Metzen say is that the considerations that are expressed in Senator Limmer's amendment are part of the discussion that employers have with their employees as they go through the collective bargaining process. And so what I understood him to say is that this issue of whether people are going to lose their jobs versus taking less money in pay is something that is discussed, whether it's school districts, whether it's the state, whomever it may be, that's part of the negotiating process. But once a collective bargaining agreement is reached, we have contracts with employees about what we have to pay. And I think that's why, again, what I understood Senator Metzen to say, this doesn't add anything, and I'm guessing Senator Limmer, whoever drafted this for you, told you that that's why you have to have the may rather than must, because we cannot unilaterally decide to alter contracts with employees. And so when I look at this, I would just concur that this just doesn't add anything. I don't think this does anything, and that's why I won't be supporting it.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Olson, I had this discussion or this inquiry last year with the administration. They said that since there was a labor contract already ratified without this type of language, the only alternative they would have if a revenue stream was shortened like it is now is to lay off. It's not to reduce benefits. That's why this is important to put into this ratification now. Otherwise, we are restricted on options, and then only layoff may occur.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't think that anything in your amendment would change that, Senator Limmer, because, as I said, we have laws that govern contracts. Going into this next negotiation session, as Senator Metzen said, our executive branch negotiated another contract, and we cannot in the legislature unilaterally change those contracts. If someone wants to come back and renegotiate and both sides were amenable, they certainly could do that, but we cannot unilaterally do that, and nothing in this amendment would change that.
Is there further discussion on the A2 amendment? There's been a roll call requested. Senator Limmer has moved adoption of the A2 amendment. There being no further discussion, the secretary will take the roll. All senators voting who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 19 ayes, 43 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Further discussion on Senate File 2386. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, would Senator Metzen yield for a couple questions, please?
He will yield.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator, now I know you're the carrier of the message here, and I understand that part. But I'm wondering, in your discussions before putting the bill together, if those messengers talked about the possibility of going to arbitration or impasse, or you know, that's been thrown around here. But in light of the fact that we don't have any money at the county, city, township level, and for sure at the state level, we all know that, was there any talk about from the administration with regards to holding off and maybe letting an arbitrator make the decision?
No.
Senator Metzen.
No.
Okay, thank you for that. And I guess with your comment regards to it's the Republican administration that's bringing this bill forward, that we should all rubber stamp it. I guess I've got a problem with that. I didn't rubber stamp the administration coming forward with buying a new park for $20 million or $70 million for a prison. But my point is, apparently you're okay with the administration, the Republican administration, bringing this forward?
Senator Metzen.
This, you're not listening very well, and all due respect, this is labor and the administration. It's not just the administration. It's called collective bargaining. It's been going on for a long time. It works. And I only mentioned the Republican administration because I thought I had to at one point. But no, it's collective bargaining with the unions and the administration.
Senator Ingebrigtsen. There being no further discussion, Senator Metzen renews his motion that when this committee do arise, Senate File 2386 be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails and the bill will be recommended to pass. Senator Pogemiller, we are through. Oh, Senator Moi.
Mr. Chair, I move that when this committee do arise, that House File 3128 be recommended to pass.
Members, we are on General Orders Calendar Number 47. Senator Waz moved that when this committee do arise, House File Number 3128 be recommended to pass. Senator Moi, on your motion.
Mr. Chair, members, this is the bill that I spoke to earlier regarding the Substitute Decision Makers Network in cleaning up some language with respect to the package of bills we passed last year regarding guardians and conservators. I would appreciate your support.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Moore, I want to thank you for progressing this bill for an amendment that I had being prepared. I'd like to introduce the A1 amendment at this time.
The Secretary will report the A1 amendment.
Senator Limmer moves to amend House File 3128 as follows. Page 1 after line 17, insert. This is Amendment A-1.
Senator Limmer, on your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Moore, members, the A1 amendment makes reference to some of the advanced directives in the bill. And this revisits an area of the anatomical gift provisions in law. The amendment before you gives clarification to people that if they decide to donate their organs and then later decide they do not want to donate organs, they're given the option to check a box on the application form. You've seen it on driver's licenses. With a check to refuse to donate. It's their option to consider that, and that it would be an advance directive for this right of refusal. This has eluded our lawmaking in this area of law for a number of years, and I simply would like to bring it up and give everyone the full range, the full spectrum of making a decision and making it known to anyone that may be dealing with them in an emergency crisis.
Senator Moi.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm a little bit confused about what this is trying to do. If you don't do anything now, it's a refusal. You have to affirmatively check off on your driver's license. So I don't support the amendment.
Senator Limmer.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Moi, if someone refuses, right now existing law would allow them to, as long as there's no copy anywhere of them refusing, a loved one could donate their organs. So there is no real refusal unless we recognize there is one. Now, one can revoke. Let's say they changed their minds that they wanted to donate and then later they decided not to. That would be a revocation, but that is not a refusal. So a member of the family could donate despite their verbal wishes. So we're simply giving them the option, putting the full spectrum on an application form that they would have a right to say, no, I prefer not to.
Further discussion on the A1 amendment. Roll call has been requested. Are there three hands for a roll call? There will be a roll call. Further discussion on the A1 amendment. There's been a roll call requested. Senator Limmer has moved the adoption of the A1 amendment. The secretary will take the roll. All senators voting who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There will be 26 ayes, 38 nays. The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. Further discussion on House File 3128. There being no further discussion, Senator Moab renews her motion that when this committee do arise, House File number 3128 be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the bill will be recommended to pass. Senator Pogamiller.
Mr. Chairman, I move the committee do now rise and report.
Senator Pogamiller moves that the committee do not rise and report. All in favor of that motion indicate signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Senator Pogamiller.
Mr. President, I move that the report of the committee of the whole as kept by the secretary be now adopted.
On Senator Pogamiller's motion, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.
Mr. President, is there any work at the desk?
Senator Pogamiller, we are caught up with work at the desk.
Thank you, Mr. President. Members, the plan, we are meeting tomorrow. Apparently the House, the other body, received a large number of bills over the holidays, and so they need an extra day to process some paper. So they would like to meet tomorrow. So tomorrow we will meet, we'll do some general orders, and then Thursday we will just have a... I don't know that we'll do much on the floor on Thursday. We'll just... my recommendation would be is that committees meet on Thursday. We would just have a session to process paper perhaps on Thursday, unless something exciting comes up, but I don't think it will. I would yield for announcements.
Announcements of Senate interest, Senator Pretner Solon.
Thank you, Mr. President. There will be a joint meeting of the Environment and Natural Resources Forestry Subcommittee and the Energy, Utilities, and Technology and Communications Committee in room 123 is starting in 10 minutes. It will last not longer than 1 hour, but then the Energy, Utilities, Technology, and Communications Committee will meet following that very briefly for confirmation of a PUC commissioner and also for a recommendation and also for a presentation on community energy conservation.
Senator Betzold.
Thank you, Mr. President. Tomorrow, the State Government Budget Division is going to meet at 10 o'clock. An earlier notice went out saying it was going to be at 12:30. It'll be at 10 o'clock tomorrow, the State Government Budget Division. Thank you.
Further announcements of Senate interest, Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I have not spoken to Senator Lynch about this, but I know that what I'm about to say are words that she would echo as well. The people of Rochester were shocked yesterday as we learned that a local serviceman, a Marine, was killed in Afghanistan last Friday. His name is Lance Corporal Curtis Swenson. And he'll be returning to Rochester on Friday and we'll be going through the funeral arrangements and so on and so forth. But perhaps before we leave today, if we could all maybe stand and offer a moment of silence to a public servant that has given his life for this state and this country, I would appreciate it.
All senators stand in respect for the passing of Curtis Swenson for a moment of silence. Thank you. Without exception, the following senators will be excused from today's session. Senator Murphy all day, Senator Ortman from 12 to 12:35, Senator Fulby from 12:20 to 12:25, Senator Pappas from 12:15 to 12:40, and Senator Wieger from 2:50 to 2:55. There are no further announcements. Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. President, I have been moved that the Senate adjourn till Wednesday, April 7th, 11 a.m.
Senator Pogemiller has moved that the Senate adjourn to 11 o'clock Wednesday, April 7th. All in favor of that motion indicate by saying aye. Opposed? The Senate is adjourned.